the cradle, neither could bear to see the other succeed. The two princes outgrew their father's realm of Aeolia, as Thessaly was called in those days, and moved east to found their own kingdoms. Salmoneus ruled over Elis, and Sisyphus established Ephyra, later called Corinth. From these fastnesses, they glared at each other across the Peloponnese, their bitter enmity growing with each passing year. Sisyphus hated Salmoneus so much it robbed him of his sleep. He wanted him dead, dead, dead. The desire was so agonizing, he stabbed himself repeatedly in the thigh with a dagger to relieve himself of it. But there was nothing he could do. The Furies would avenge themselves terribly if he dared murder a brother. Fratricide was among the worst of the blood crimes. Eventually, he decided to consult the oracle at Delphi. "Sons of Sisyphus and Tyro, rise to slay Salmoneus," intoned the Pythia. This was sweet music to Sisyphus's ears. Tyro was his niece, daughter of his hated brother Salmoneus. All Sisyphus had to do was marry and get sons from her, sons who would rise to slay Salmoneus. Uncles could marry nieces without raising any eyebrows in those days, and so he set about beguiling and seducing Tyro with horses, jewels, poems, and oceans of personal charm, for Sisyphus was nothing if not captivating when he chose to be. In due course, his wooing won her. They wed, and she bore him two bouncing boys. One day, some years later, Sisyphus was out fishing with his friend Melops. Sunning themselves on the banks of the river Cythas, they fell into conversation. At exactly the same time, Tyro set out from the palace with a maid, the two boys, now aged 5 and 3, and a hamper of food and wine, with the idea of surprising Sisyphus with a family picnic. Back on the riverbank, Melops and Sisyphus talked lazily about horses, women, sport, and war. Tyro's group made their way across the fields. "Tell me, sire," said Melops, "it has always surprised me that, despite your bitter feud with King Salmoneus, you chose to marry his daughter. For all that I can tell, you still dislike him as much as ever." "Dislike him? I abominate, loathe, despise, and abhor him," said Sisyphus with a loud laugh. A laugh that allowed the approaching Tyro to draw a bead on his exact position. As her party drew nearer, she could now hear every word her husband spoke. "I only married that bitch, Tyro, because I hate Salmoneus so much," he was saying. "You see, the oracle at Delphi told me that if I had sons by her, they would grow up to kill him. So when he dies by the hand of his own grandchildren, I will be rid of my vile pig of a brother without fear of the pursuit of the Erinyes." "That is," Melops tried to find the word, "brilliant, cunning, ingenious." Tyro checked her sons, who were about to run to the spot from which they could hear their father's voice. Turning them round, she pushed them at speed towards a bend in the river, the maid following behind. Tyro had swallowed Sisyphus's charm whole, but she loved her father Salmoneus with a loyalty that overrode any other consideration. The idea of allowing her sons to grow up to kill their grandfather was out of the question. She knew how to defy the oracle's prophecy. "Come, child," she said to the eldest, "look down at the stream. Can you see any little fishes?" The small boy knelt on the river bank and looked down. Tyro put a hand to his neck and pushed him under. When he had stopped struggling, she did the same to the youngest. "Now," she said quite calmly to the traumatized maid, "this is what you will do." Sisyphus and Melops caught plenty of fish that afternoon. Just as the light was fading, and they had started to pack up for the day, Tyro's maidservant appeared before them, bobbing a nervous curtsy.
"Beg pardon, Majesty, but the Queen asks that you might greet the princes. They are by the riverbank awaiting your Majesty, just behind the willow tree, sire."
Sisyphus went to the place indicated to find his two sons lying stretched out on the grass, pale and lifeless. The maid ran for her life and was never heard of again. Tyro, by the time the enraged Sisyphus had reached the palace with drawn sword, was safely on her way to her father's kingdom of Elis. On her arrival home, Salmoneus married her to his brother Cretheus, with whom she was deeply unhappy. Salmoneus himself, quite as proud and vainglorious as his hated brother, had set himself up in Elis as a kind of god, claiming to equal Zeus's power to summon storms. He'd ordered the construction of a brass bridge, over which he liked to ride his chariot at breakneck speed, trailing kettles, cauldrons, and iron pots to mimic the sound of thunder. Flaming torches would be thrown skywards at the same time to imitate lightning. Such blasphemous impertinence caught the eye of Zeus, who ended the farrago with a real thunderbolt. The king, his chariot, brass bridge, cooking utensils and all were blasted to atoms, and the shade of Salmoneus cast down to eternal damnation in the darkest depths of Tartarus. Sisyphean Tasks. Sisyphus held a great feast to celebrate the death of his preposterous thunder-making brother. The morning after, he was awoken by a deputation of aggrieved lords, landowners, and tenant farmers. After he had rubbed the sleep from his eyes and cleared his headache with a goblet of unwatered wine, he consented to hear what might be the matter.
"Majesty, someone is stealing our cattle. Each one of us can report a loss. Your own royal herds are depleted too. You are a wise and clever king. Surely you can find out who is responsible."
Sisyphus dismissed them with a promise to investigate. He had a very good idea that the thief was his neighbour Autolycus, but how to prove it? Sisyphus was guileful and smart, but Autolycus was a son of Hermes himself, the prince of robbers and rascals, the god who as an infant had rustled Apollo's cattle. From Hermes, Autolycus had inherited not only this propensity to take cows that didn't belong to him, but also powers of enchantment that made it very difficult to catch him in the act. The rascally entertainer, pickpocket, tinker, and snapper-up of unconsidered trifles in Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale is called Autolycus. Besides, the cattle that Sisyphus and his neighbours had lost were brown and white and generously horned, while those of Autolycus were black and white and entirely hornless. It was baffling, but Sisyphus was sure that spells taught by Hermes were behind it, and that Autolycus was secretly colour-changing stolen cows.
"Very well," he said to himself. "We shall see which proves the more powerful, the cheap magic of a trickster god's bastard, or the native wit and intelligence of Sisyphus, founder of Corinth, the cleverest king in the world."
He commanded that all his and his neighbour's cattle should have the words, "Autolycus stole me," carved into their hoofs in tiny lettering. Over the next 7 nights, as expected, the local herds continued regularly to be depleted. On the eighth day, Sisyphus and the leading landowners paid Autolycus a visit. "Greetings, my friends," their neighbour cried with a cheery wave. "To what do I owe the honour of this visit?" "We have come to inspect your cattle," said Sisyphus. "By all means. Are you thinking of breeding black and whites yourself? My pedigree herd is unique in the region, they tell me."
"Oh, it's unique, all right," returned Sisyphus. "Whoever saw hoofs like this?" He lifted the foreleg of one of the cows.
Autolycus leaned forward, read the words carved into the hoof, and gave a cheerful shrug.
"Ah," he said, "fun while it lasted."
"Take them all," commanded Sisyphus. As the landowners led the animals away, Sisyphus looked towards Autolycus's house.
"I think I'll help myself to all your cows," he said, "every last heifer."
By which he meant Amphithea, Autolycus's wife. Sisyphus was not a good man. This violation of Amphithea gave rise to the rumour that Sisyphus was the true father of Autolycus's daughter, Anticlea. Anticlea begat Laertes, and Laertes begat the great hero Odysseus, a.k.a. Ulysses, who was known above all for his wiliness and resource.
The Eagle.
The achievement of outsmarting the progeny of the trickster god went to Sisyphus's head. He began to believe that he really was the cleverest and most resourceful man in the world. He set himself up as a kind of royal problem solver, pronouncing on all manner of issues brought to him and charging enormous sums for his rulings. But there is a difference between guile and good sense, cunning and judgment, quick-wittedness and wisdom. Do you recall the Asopos? It was in the waters of this Boeotian river that the Theban priestess Semele had washed, attracting the attentions of Zeus and bringing about the birth of Dionysus. Unhappily, the god of that river had a daughter, Aegina, who was beautiful enough to catch Zeus's eye. In the form of an eagle, the god swooped down and seized the girl, taking her to an island off the coast of Attica. The distraught river god searched everywhere for her, asking everyone he met if they had seen any sign of his beloved daughter.
"A young girl dressed in goatskin, you say," responded Sisyphus when his turn came to be pressed for information. "Why, yes, I saw just such a maiden snatched up by an eagle not long ago. She had been bathing in the river when, out of the sun, he dived. It was the most... Where did he take her? Did you see?" "Are those bracelets real gold? I must say they're very fine."
"Take them, they're yours. Only for pity's sake, tell me what happened to Aegina."
"I was high on a hill, so I saw the whole thing. The eagle took her to that ring of yours. An emerald, is it?
Why, thank you. Now, let me see. Yes, they flew across the sea and landed there, on that island. Come to the window. You can just make it out on the horizon. See? Inone, they call the island, I believe. That's where you'll find them. Oh, are you leaving?"
Asopus chartered a boat and made his way to the island.
He hadn't made it halfway over before Zeus saw him coming and sent a thunderbolt across his bows. Its blast swept Asopus and his boat in a great tidal bore up his own estuary and into his river. Asopus had charge of at least two rivers. There was the one in Boeotia that watered Thebes and this one which ran through Corinth. But Sisyphus! Zeus had had his eye on that villain for some time. It had not gone unnoticed to the god of Xenia that Sisyphus had a history of abusing the guests that travelled in his lands,
taxing them, plundering their treasures, making free with their women, shamelessly transgressing every canon of the sacred laws of hospitality. And now he presumed to interfere in matters that were none of his business, to meddle in the affairs of his betters, to tell tales on the king of the gods himself. It was time to take measures. An example must be set that would serve as a warning to others. Death and damnation to him. Despite his royal blood, Sisyphus's life had been too wicked, too shameless, Zeus ruled, to merit the dignity of his being conducted to the underworld by Hermes. Instead, Thanatos, death himself, was sent to shackle and escort him. Cheating death. Thanatos always enjoyed, inasmuch as so gloomy a spirit was capable of so cheerful an emotion, that moment when he manifested himself in front of those marked down for death. Appearing before them and visible to no one else, his gaunt form cloaked in black, wisps of hellish gases streaming from him, he would stretch out his arm to his victims with a cruelly deliberate slowness. The moment he touched their flesh with the tip of his bony finger, there would come a piteous whimper from the soul within. Thanatos took great delight in watching his victim's skin go pale and the eyes flutter and film over as life was extinguished. Above all, he loved the sound of the soul's last shuddering sigh as it emerged from its mortal carcass and submitted itself to his manacles, ready to be led away. Sisyphus, as most wily, ambitious schemers are, was a light sleeper. His mind was always turning, and the slightest noise could jerk him awake. Thus it was that even the silent whisper of death gliding into his bedchamber caused him to sit up.
"Who the hell are you?"
"Who the hell, indeed? The hell is just who I am." Thanatos unloosed the sinister, ghoulish laugh that so often sent dying mortals screaming mad.
"Stop groaning. What's the matter with you? Have you got toothache? Indigestion? And don't talk in riddles. What is your name?"
"My name..." Thanatos paused for effect. "My name... I haven't got all night. My name is...
Have you even got a name?"
"Thanatos."
"Oh, so you're death, are you?
Sisyphus seemed unimpressed.
"I thought you'd be taller."
"Sisyphus, son of Aeolus," Thanatos intoned in quelling accents. "King of Corinth, lord of..."
"Yes, yes, I know who I am. You're the one who seems to have trouble remembering their name. Sit down, why don't you? Take the weight off your feet."
"My weight is not on my feet. I am hovering."
Sisyphus looked down at the floor. "Oh, yes, there you are. And you've come for me, have you?"
Not confident that any words of his would be received with the respect and awe they deserved, Thanatos showed Sisyphus his manacles and shook them threateningly in his face.
"So you brought shackles along. Iron?"
"Steel. Unbreakable steel. Fetters forged in the fires of Hephaestus by Steropes the Cyclops, enchanted by my lord Hades. Whomsoever they bind cannot be unbound, save by the god himself."
"Impressive," Sisyphus conceded. "But in my experience, nothing is unbreakable. Besides, there isn't even a lock or catch.
The hasp and spring are too cunningly contrived to be seen by mortal eyes. So you say. I don't believe for a second that they work. I bet you can't close them, even round your skinny arm. Go on, try. Such open ridicule of his prized manacles could not be borne. Foolish man, cried Thanatos. Such intricate devices are beyond the understanding of a mortal. See, here, round my back once and pass in front. Easy. Bring my wrists together, then close up the bracelets, and if you would be good enough to press just here to engage the clasp, there's an invisible panel, and behold!
Yes, I see, said Sisyphus thoughtfully. I do see. I was wrong, quite wrong. What superb workmanship.
Oh. Thanatos tried to wave the manacles, but his whole upper body was now constrained and immobile. Help? Sisyphus sprang from his bed and opened the door of a large wardrobe at the end of the room. It was the simplest thing in the world to send the hovering, tightly bound Thanatos across the room. With one push, he had glided in and bumped his nose on the back of the closet. Turning the key on him, Sisyphus called out cheerily, "The lock to this wardrobe may be cheap and man-made, but I can assure you that it works as well as any fetters forged in the fires of Hephaestus." Muffled, despairing cries came, begging to be let out, but with a hearty "mwahahaha," Sisyphus skipped away, deaf to death's entreaties. Life without death. The first few days of Thanatos's imprisonment passed without incident. Neither Zeus nor Hermes, nor even Hades himself, thought to verify that Sisyphus had been checked into the infernal region as arranged. But when a whole week passed, without the arrival of any new dead souls, the spirits and demons of the underworld began to murmur. Another week went by, and not a single departed shade had been admitted for processing, save one venerable priestess of Artemis, whose blameless life merited the honour of a personal escort to Elysium by Hermes the Psychopomp. This sudden stemming of the flow of souls quite perplexed the denizens of Hades, until someone remarked that they hadn't seen Thanatos in days. Search parties were sent out, but death could not be found. Such a thing had never happened before. Without Thanatos, the whole system collapsed. In Olympus, opinion was divided. Dionysus found the whole situation hilarious and drank a toast to the end of lethal cirrhosis of the liver. Apollo, Artemis, and Poseidon were more or less neutral on the subject. Demeter feared that Persephone's authority as queen of the underworld was being flouted. The seasons over which mother and daughter had dominion required that life be constantly ended and begun again, and only the presence of death could achieve this. The impropriety of such a scandal made Hera quite indignant, which made Zeus restive in turn. The usually merry and irrepressible Hermes was anxious too, for the smooth running of the underworld was partly his responsibility. But it was Ares who found the situation most intolerable. He was outraged. He looked down and saw battles being fought in the human realm with their customary ferocity, yet no one was dying. Warriors were being run through with javelins, trampled by horses, gutted by chariot wheels, and beheaded by swords, but they would not die. It made a mockery of combat. If soldiers and civilians did not die, why then, war had no point It settled nothing. It achieved nothing. Neither side in a battle could ever win. Lesser deities were as divided over the issue as the Olympians. The Keres continued to drink the blood of those slain in battle and could not care less what happened to their souls. Two of the Horai, Dike and Eunomia, agreed with Demeter that the absence of death upset the natural order of things. Their sister Irene, the goddess of peace, could barely contain her delight. If the absence of death meant the absence of war, then surely her time had come. Ares nagged his parents, Hera and Zeus, with such incessant clamour that at last they could bear it no longer. They declared that Thanatos must be found. Hera demanded to know when he had last been seen. "Surely, Hermes," said Zeus, "it wasn't so long ago that you sent him to fetch the soul of that black-hearted villain Sisyphus." "Damn!" Hermes slapped his thigh in annoyance. "Of course, Sisyphus! We sent Thanatos to chain him up and escort him to Hades. Wait here." The wings at Hermes' heels fluttered, flickered, and hummed, and he was gone. He returned in the blink of an eye. Sisyphus never reached the underworld. Thanatos was sent to Corinth to fetch him half a moon ago, and neither has been seen since.
"Corinth!" roared Ares. "What are we waiting for?"
The locked wardrobe in the bedchamber was soon found and wrenched open, revealing a humiliated Thanatos sitting tearfully in the corner under some cloaks. Hermes took him to the infernal regions, where Hades waved his hand to release the enchanted manacles.
"We will speak about this later, Thanatos," he said. "For the moment, a logjam of souls awaits you."
"First, let me fetch that villain Sisyphus, sire," pleaded Thanatos. "He won't be able to trick me twice."
Hermes arched an eyebrow, but Hades looked across to Persephone, sitting in her throne next to his. She nodded. Thanatos was her favourite amongst all the servants of the underworld.
"Just make sure you don't foul it up," grunted Hades, dismissing him with a wave of the hand.
Burial Rites. We have established that Sisyphus was no fool. He did not imagine for a second that Thanatos would stay locked in his closet for eternity. Sooner or later, death would be released and set upon his trail once more. In the town villa in which he had made temporary lodging, Sisyphus addressed his wife. After his niece Tyro drowned his sons and left him, he had married again. His new young queen was as kindly and obedient as Tyro had been willful and contrary. "My dear," he said, drawing her to him, "I feel that soon I shall die. When I have breathed my last and my soul has fled, what will you do?"
"I will do what must be done, my lord. I will wash and anoint you. I will place an obolus on your tongue so that you might pay the ferryman. We will stand guard 7 days and 7 nights over your catafalque. Burnt offerings will be sent up to please the king and queen of the underworld. And in this way, your journey to the meadows of Asphodel shall be a blessed one."
"You mean well, but that is exactly what you must not do," said Sisyphus. "The moment I am dead, I want you to strip me naked and have me thrown into the street."
"My lord!"
I'm quite serious, deadly serious. This is my desire, my entreaty, my command. No matter what anyone else says, you will send up no prayers, make no sacrifices, perform no obsequies. Treat my remains as you would those of a dog. Promise me that."
"But..."
Sisyphus took her by the shoulders and looked deep into her eyes to reinforce the earnestness of his commands. "As you love me,
and are bound to me, as you hope never to be haunted by my angry shade, promise to do exactly as I have said. Swear it, on your soul.
I swear it.
It is good. Now, let us drink a toast to life. His timing, as ever, was impeccable, for that very evening Sisyphus was awoken by the whisper of death at his bedside.
Your time is come, Sisyphus of Corinth.
Ah, Thanatos, I've been expecting you.
Do not hope to trick me.
Me? Trick you?
Sisyphus stood and bowed in meek submission, putting up his wrists for shackling.
Nothing could be further from my mind. The manacles were attached, and the pair glided down to the mouth of the underworld. Thanatos left Sisyphus at the near bank of the Styx and departed, anxious to make headway with the great backlog of souls that were awaiting collection.
Charon the ferryman sculled his boat across, and Sisyphus stepped aboard. As he pulled the boat off the bank, Charon stretched out his palm.
Nothing doing,
said Sisyphus, patting his pockets.
Without a word, Charon pushed him overboard into the blackness of the Styx. It was cold, abominably cold, but Sisyphus managed to get across. The waters burned and blistered his skin almost beyond endurance, but once he was on the other side, he knew that he presented just such a piteous sight as he had intended. Shades flitted past him, averting their eyes.
Which way to the throne room? He asked of one. Following their directions, he found himself in the presence of Persephone.
Dread queen, Sisyphus inclined his head, I beg an audience with Hades.
My husband is in Tartarus today. I speak for him. Who are you? And how can you dare stand before me in this condition?
Sisyphus was naked. An ear was torn off, and one of his eyes hung down from its socket. His spectral body was covered in bite marks, welts, bruises, gashes, and open sores, testimony to its physical counterpart's rough treatment on the streets of Corinth above. His wife had obeyed his instructions.
Madam, he bowed low before Persephone, no one feels the impropriety of this as keenly as I. My wife, my spiteful, wicked, monstrous, blasphemous wife, it is she who has brought me to this pitiable state. Even as I lay dying, I heard her say to her women, We will not waste gold on burial rites. The gods of the underworld are nothing to us. Throw his body outside for the dogs to eat. Spend the money he set aside for his funeral on a great feast. The heifers he kept for sacrificing to Hades and Persephone shall be roasted for our pleasure. She laughed and clapped her hands. And those, dread queen, were the last sounds I heard in the world.
Persephone was outraged.
She dared? She dared? She shall be punished.
Aye, Majesty, but how?
Flayed alive.
Yes, not bad. But I say, permit me, wouldn't it be funny?
Sisyphus smiled as an idea struck him.
Wouldn't it be funny if you returned me to the upper world alive?
Imagine her shock.
And I would make sure that every day she paid for her insolence and disrespect. No gold or feasting, nothing but harsh treatment, insults and servitude. I can't wait to see her face when I appear in front of her, alive and well and whole and perhaps even more youthful and vital and handsome than ever. She's only 26, but imagine her torment if I outlived her. I would use her as my slave. Every day would be torture to her.
Persephone smiled at the thought and clapped her hands.
Let it be so.
The years spent in the underworld had given Persephone a regal pride and rigid belief in the proper running of the infernal kingdom. And thus it was that Sisyphus was led out to the upper world, where he and his delighted queen lived happily ever after. His death, when it finally did come, was another matter. Rolling the Rock. Zeus, Ares, Hermes, and Hades had not been pleased when they found out how Sisyphus had evaded death for a second time. Persephone had made her decision, however, and the ruling of one immortal could not be undone by another. When, after nearly 50 more years of serene and prosperous living, his wife's mortal span came at last to its end, the contract between Persephone and Sisyphus expired with her. Thanatos paid him a third and final visit. This time Sisyphus gave Charon the fee and crossed the Styx in good order. Hermes awaited him on the farther bank. Well, 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 King Sisyphus of Corinth, liar, fraud, rogue, and trickster, a man after my own heart. No mortal has managed to cheat death once. You contrive to do it twice. Clever you. Sisyphus bowed. Such an achievement deserves a chance at immortality. Follow me. Hermes led Sisyphus down innumerable passageways and galleries to a vast underground chamber. A great ramp sloped up from the floor to the ceiling. A boulder stood at the bottom, lit by a shaft of light. "The upper world," said Hermes, indicating the source of the light. Sisyphus saw that the slope led up to a square inlet high in the roof, through which a beam of daylight shone. As Hermes pointed, the inlet closed up and the shaft of light disappeared. "Now, all you have to do is roll that boulder up the slope. When you reach the top, that hole will slide open. You will be able to climb out and live forever. As the immortal King Sisyphus, Thanatos will never visit you again." "That's it?" "That's it," said Hermes. "Of course, if you don't like the idea, I can take you to Elysium, where you will spend a blissful eternity in the company of other souls of the virtuous departed. But if you choose the stone, you must keep trying until you have succeeded and won your freedom and immortality. Make your choice, an idyllic afterlife down here, or a shot at immortality above." Sisyphus examined the boulder. It was bulky, but not colossally so. The slope was steep, but not precipitously. 45 degrees of gradient, but no more. So, an eternity skipping through the fields of Elysium with the dull and well-behaved, or eternity up above, in the real world of fun, filth, frolic, and frenzy. "No tricks, no tricks, no pressure," said Hermes, putting his hand on Sisyphus's shoulder and flashing his most dazzling smile. "Your choice." You know the rest. Sisyphus put his shoulder to the boulder and began to push it up the slope. Halfway there, and he was confident that life eternal was assured. 3/4 done, and he was tired, but not blown. 4/5, and damn, this was hard work. 5/6, pain. 6/7, agony. 7/8, he was within an inch of the top now, within a fingernail's length. Just one more supreme effort, and no!
The stone slipped, bounced over Sisyphus, and rolled down to the bottom. Well, not bad for a first effort, Sisyphus thought to himself. If I take my time, if I conserve my strength, I can get there. I know I can. I'll discover a technique. Maybe I'll go up backwards, taking the weight on my back. I can do this. Sisyphus is still there in the halls of Tartarus, pushing that boulder up the hill and getting almost to the top before it rolls back down, and he has to start once again. He will be there until the end of time. He still believes he can do it. Just one last supreme effort, and he will be free. Painters, poets, and philosophers have seen many things in the myth of Sisyphus. They have seen an image of the absurdity of human life, the futility of effort, the remorseless cruelty of fate, the unconquerable power of gravity. But they have seen, too, something of mankind's courage, resilience, fortitude, endurance, and self-belief. They see something heroic in our refusal to submit. Hubris. To the Greeks, hubris was a special kind of pride. It often led mortals to defy the gods, bringing about inevitable punishment of one kind or another. It is a common, if not essential, flaw in the makeup of the heroes of Greek tragedy and of many leading characters in Greek myth. Sometimes the failing is not ours, but the gods, who are too jealous, petty, and vain to accept that mortals can equal or surpass them. All tears. You may remember that Pelops was not the only child of Tantalus and Dione. They also had a daughter, Niobe. Despite the terrible fate that befell her father and the bleak adventures of her brother, she was a proud, confident woman. She had met and married Amphion, the son of Zeus and Antiope. He was a former lover of Hermes, you may recall, one of the twins who had constructed the walls of Thebes, enchanting the stones with his singing and strumming of the lyre. Once he had married Niobe and taken her to Thebes, the city he helped found, Amphion added three strings to that lyre so that, in honour of her birthplace in Asia Minor, he could play music in what is still called the Lydian mode. Between them, Niobe and Amphion had seven daughters and seven sons, the Niobids. Swollen with dangerous levels of conceit and self-regard, Niobe liked to tell all who would listen how important she was and just how royal and divine her bloodlines were. On my mother's side, I claim descent from Tethys and Oceanus, they're first-generation titans, you know. On my father's side, well, there's Tmolus, of course, the most high-born of all the Lydian mountain deities. My dear husband Amphion is a son of Zeus and of Antiope, the daughter of King Nyctius, one of the original Theban Spartoi who sprang from the dragon's teeth. So my darling sons and daughters really can boast the most distinguished lineage, one feels justified in saying, of any family in the world. Not that I ever allow them to boast, of course. The well-bred are never puffed up. Such foolishness might have been no more than faintly sad, were it not that Niobe even presumed to compare herself to the Titaness Leto, mother of gods. On the very day that the people of Thebes gathered annually to sing Leto's praises and tell the story of Artemis and Apollo's miraculous birth on Delos, on that very day, sacred to the Titaness and her dignity, Niobe unburdened herself of her haughtiest broadside. I mean, I'd be the first to admit that Leto's dear twins, Artemis and Apollo, are charming and fully divine. Of course they are.
But only two children? One girl and one boy? Good heavens, how she can even call herself a mother, I fail to understand. And who's to say that of my seven sons and seven daughters, there won't be some, if not all, who will ascend to divine and immortal rank? Given their birth, I think it is rather more likely than not, don't you? In my view, celebrations of such a lazy, vulgar, and unproductive mother as Leto are in extremely poor taste. Next year, I shall make sure the festival is cancelled altogether. At this time, as in the subsequent Age of Heroes, there was always the possibility of humans attaining immortal rank. It was to happen to Hercules. In later civilizations, Roman emperors could be deified, Roman Catholics sanctified, and film actors catastrophized in the Hollywood Walk of Fame. When word reached Leto that this jumped-up Theban was insulting her in such a fashion and daring to set herself up over her, she burst into tears in front of her sympathetic twins. "That terrible, boastful, conceited woman," she choked. "She called me lazy for having only two children. She said I was unproductive. And she called me vulgar. She said she would prevent the people of Thebes from celebrating my festal day."
Artemis put an arm round her, while Apollo paced up and down, slamming the ball of his fist into his palm.
"She has 14 children," wailed Leto. "So I suppose, compared to her, I am inadequate."
"Enough," said Artemis. "Come, brother. She has made our mother weep. It is time this woman knew the meaning of tears." Artemis and Apollo went straight to Thebes, where they hunted down every one of Amphion and Niobe's 14 children. Artemis shot the seven daughters dead with her silver arrows. Apollo shot the seven sons dead with his golden ones. When Niobe was brought news of the slaughter, she fled to her childhood home and found refuge on the slopes of Mount Sipylus. Her grief was insupportable. Amphion's response to the massacre of his children was to take his own life by falling on his sword. No matter how snobbish, reckless, proud, and absurd she had been, such wretched and inconsolable unhappiness was terrible to behold. The gods themselves could not bear to hear her unceasing lamentations and turned her to stone. But not even solid rock had the power to hold back such tears as these. Niobe's weeping pushed her tears through the stone and sent them cascading in waterfalls down the mountainside. Even today, visitors to Sipylus, now called Mount Spil, can see the rock formation in which the outlines of a female face can still be discerned. In Turkish, this is known as Aglayan Kaya, or Weeping Rock. It looks down on the city of Manisa, the modern name for Tantalus. The waters that gush from this rock will flow forever in their grief. The rock is limestone, but the element niobium, very similar in composition and characteristics to tantalum, is named after the Queen of Tears. Apollo and Marsyas, puffed cheeks. Mortal humans were not the only beings capable of exhibiting excessive pride. The goddess Athena's injured self-regard led, indirectly, to the downfall of a conceited human called Marsyas. It all began when Athena proudly invented a new musical instrument, which she named the aulos. It was a double-reeded pipe of what we would call the woodwind family, not unlike the modern oboe or cor anglais. It is a pleasing coincidence that one of the chief uses of palladium, the element named in Pallas Athene's honour, is in the manufacture of woodwind instruments. Or is it a coincidence? There was one problem with this splendid instrument. Whenever Athena played it, gorgeous as the music that emerged undoubtedly was, it elicited from her fellow Olympians nothing but roars of laughter. There was no way for Athena to get a good sound from it without blowing so hard that her cheeks bulged. To see this goddess, the very personification of dignity, going all pink and swelling up like a bullfrog, was more than her disrespectful family could take without howling out loud. Wise as Athena was, and free, for the most part, of affectation and conceit, she was not entirely without vanity, and could not bear to be mocked. After 3 attempts to win the gods over with the mellifluous sounds of her new instrument, she cursed it, and cast it down from Olympus. The Aulos fell to earth in Asia Minor, in the kingdom of Phrygia, near the source of the Meander River, whose winding course lends its name to all mazy, wandering streams, where it was picked up by a satyr called Marsyas. As a follower of Dionysus, Marsyas was gifted with curiosity as well as many more disreputable traits. He dusted the Aulos off and blew into it. A small peep was the only result. He laughed and scratched at the tickling buzz in his lips. He puffed and blew hard again until a long, loud, musical note was produced. This was fun. He went on his way blowing and blowing until he could, after a surprisingly short time, play a real tune. Within a month or two, his fame had spread around all of Asia Minor and Greece. He became celebrated as Marsyas the Musical, whose skill on the Aulos could make trees dance and stones sing. He revelled in the fame and adulation that his musicianship brought. Like all satyrs, he required little more than wine, women, and song to make him happy, and his mastery of the third ensured a ready supply of the other two. One evening, the fire crackling, Maenads at his feet gazing up adoringly at him, he called drunkenly to the heavens.
"Hey there, Apollo, you, god of the lyre, you think you're so musical, but I bet if there was a competition,
suggested a drowsy Maenad.
"One of them, yes. If there was a, what she said, I'd win. Easy. Hands down. Anyone can strum a lute. Boring. But my pipes beat your strings any day. So there."
The Maenads laughed. Marsyas laughed too, belched, and fell into a contented sleep. The Competition. The next day, Marsyas set off with his many followers to Lake Aulocrene. They had arranged to meet other satyrs there for a great feast at which Marsyas would play wild corybantic dances of his own composition. He would pluck some reeds from the shores of the lake, whose very name testified to their abundance. Aulos means reed, and krine is fountain or spring, and cut himself a new mouthpiece for his Aulos. Piping and dancing, he led his followers in a merry trail of music until he turned a corner to find his way blocked by a dazzling and disturbing spectacle. In the meadow, a stage had been erected on which sat the 9 muses in a broad semicircle. At the centre of the stage, lute in hand, stood Apollo, a grim smile playing on his beautiful lips. Marcius skidded to a halt, the assorted satyrs, fauns, and maenads behind, bumping into him and each other in a concertina of confusion.
"Well, Marcius," said Apollo, "are you ready to put your brave words to the test?"
"Words? What words?"
Marcius had forgotten his drunken boast of the night before. "If there was a competition between me and Apollo," you said, "I would beat him hands down. Now is your chance to find out if that is true. The muses themselves have travelled from Parnassus to hear us and judge. Their word is final."
But I...
Marcius's mouth was suddenly very dry and his legs suddenly very wobbly.
"Are you or are you not a finer musician than I?"
Marcius heard behind him a murmur of doubt from his followers, and the flames of his pride flared up again.
"In a fair contest," he declared with a burst of bravado, "I can certainly outplay you."
Apollo's smile widened.
"Excellent. Join me up on the stage here. I shall start. Here is a little air. See if you can reply to it."
Marcius took up a position next to Apollo, who bent to tune his lyre. When this was done, he gently strummed and delicately plucked. The most beautiful melody emerged, subtle, sweet, and seductive. It came in four phrases, and as the last one sounded, Marcius's followers broke into appreciative applause. Immediately, Marcius put the aulos to his mouth and repeated the phrases. But he gave each a little tweak and modulation, a shower of grace notes here, a riffle of accidentals there. A gasp of admiration from his followers, and even a nod from Calliope herself, encouraged him to end with a flourish. Apollo replied at once with a variation on the phrases in double time. The complexity of his picking and strumming was marvellous to the ear, but Marcius responded with even greater speed, the melody bubbling and singing from his pipes with a magical splendour that provoked yet more applause from the audience. Now Apollo did something extraordinary. He turned his lyre upside down and played the phrases backwards. They still held up as a tune, but now they were imbued with a mystery and a strangeness that enthralled all who heard. When he finished, Apollo nodded to Marcius. Marcius had an excellent ear, and he started to play the inverted tunes just as Apollo had. But the god interrupted him with a sneer.
"No, no, satyr. You must turn your instrument upside down, as I did mine."
"But that's not fair," Marcius protested.
"How about this, then?" Apollo played on his lyre and sang, "Marcius can blow down the infernal thing, but while he does it, can he sing?"
Infuriated, Marcius played for all he was worth, his face purple with the effort, and his cheeks swollen so that it looked as if they must rupture. Hundreds of notes exploded in a volley of quarter notes, eighth notes, sixteenth notes, filling the air with a music that the world had never heard before. But Apollo's divine voice, the chords and arpeggios that flew from the golden strings of his lyre, how could Marcius's pipes compete with such a sound? Panting with exhaustion, sobbing with frustration, Marcius cried aloud, "Not fair! My voice and breath sing into my aulos just as much as your voice sings out into the air. Of course I cannot turn the instrument upside down, but any unbiased judge can tell that my skill is the greater." Judgment. With a final glissando of triumph, Apollo turned to the jury of muses.
Sweet sisters, it is not for me to say. It is, of course, for you to decide. To whom do you award the palm of victory?
Marcius was out of control now. Humiliation and a burning sense of injustice drove him to turn on the judges. They can't be impartial. They are your aunts or your stepsisters or some such incestuous thing. They are family. They will never dare to...
Hush, Marcius, pleaded a Maenad.
Don't listen to him, great god Apollo, urged another. He's hysterical. He's good and honourable. He means well.
It did not take the muses long to confer and to announce the results.
We unanimously declare, said Euterpe, that Apollo is the winner.
Apollo bowed and smiled sweetly. But what he did next might make you forever think less of this golden and beautiful god, the melodious Apollo of reason, charm, and harmony. He took Marcius and flayed the skin off him. There is no nice way of saying it. To punish him for his hubris in daring to challenge an Olympian, he peeled the skin from the living body of the screaming satyr and hung it on a pine tree as a lesson and warning to all. Now, if you really cannot stomach the idea of such cruelty from an otherwise so admirable god, you might prefer another reading of the story. The Hungarian philologist and mythographer Károly Karényi, one of the great pioneers of the study of Greek myth, pointed out that satyrs customarily dressed themselves in pelts of animal skin. He maintains that what Apollo actually did was confiscate the hide from Marcius so that he had to go naked. That was all. The punishment was no greater than that. This is an amiable and convincing interpretation, but not one that generations of artists ever believed. The flaying of Marcius became a favourite subject for painters, poets, and sculptors. For some, his tale echoes the fate of Prometheus, a symbol of the artist-creator's struggle to match the gods, or of the gods' refusal to accept that mortal artists can outdo the divine. One version of the myth maintains it was a capricious and sulky Apollo who challenged the gifted Marcius, not the other way around, making the fable more about divine jealousy than mortal hubris.
Arachne, the Weaver. In a small cottage outside a little town called Hypepa, in the kingdom of Lydia, there dwelt a merchant and craftsman called Idmon. He worked in the nearby Ionian city of Colophon as a trader in dyes, specializing in the highly prized color Phocian purple. His wife had died giving birth to a girl, Arachne. Idmon was as proud of Arachne as ever father was of daughter, for, since her early childhood, she had shown the most extraordinary skill as a weaver. Spinning and weaving were naturally of great importance in those days. Next to the growing of food, few things were as crucial to human welfare as the reliable manufacture of textiles for clothing and furnishing. And manufacture is quite the right word. It literally means making by hand, and all such work was done by hand then. Fleece or flax was spun into threads and loaded onto looms to be woven into woolen or linen cloth. It was so much the province of skilled women that the very gender itself was given names in some cultures and languages that reflected the practice. In English, we still talk of the distaff side of a family, meaning the female line. The distaff was the spindle around which the wool or flax was wound preparatory to spinning. And those who spun were called spinsters, a name which once applied without negative connotation to any unmarried woman. But as with almost all human practices, there are those who have the mysterious ability to raise the everyday and ordinary to the level of art. From the very first, Arachne's skill at the loom was the talk and pride of all Ionia. The speed and accuracy of her work was astonishing. The assurance and dexterity with which she selected one coloured thread after another, almost without looking, stunned the admirers, who often crowded into Idmon's cottage to watch her at work. But it was the pictures, patterns, and intricate designs that emerged from under the blur of her shuttle that caused onlookers to burst into spontaneous applause and declare her without equal. The forests, palaces, seascapes, and mountain views she created were so real that you felt you could jump into them. It wasn't only the mortal citizens of Colophon and Hypaper that came to see her at her loom. Local naiads from the river Pactolus and oreads from nearby Mount Tmolus crowded into the cottage and shook their heads in wonder too. All were agreed that Arachne was the kind of phenomenon that might come only once in 5 centuries of history. To be so technically skilled was cause for admiration enough, but to be endowed with such taste. She never overdid the use of purples, or other costly and showy dyes, for example. That was the miracle. Such praise as she daily received would have gone to anyone's head. Arachne was not a spoiled or